You probably washed your face this morning with something, a soap, washcloth, a scrub, and then you may have also slathered on a moisturizer or a sunscreen or both. Caring for our skin is a serious matter for most of us, and the business of skincare, from soaps and creams to chemical peels and lasers, is a multi-billion dollar industry. Skin and how we care for it is the subject of today's edition of Please Explain, and joining me now to discuss it are Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Jesse Chung, Associate Director of Cosmetic Dermatology and Assistant Professor of Dermatology at NYU Langone Medical Center. It's a pleasure to welcome you both to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Should I use your first names, or should I? Do you prefer the doctors?
Oh, please call me Michelle.
Michelle, on Please Explain, we usually begin with the most basic question. So can you tell us a bit about skin and how it functions?
Oh, my pleasure. So the skin is very important. It's, as dermatologists like to say, it's our largest organ. And it serves to keep everything that needs to be inside the body inside, everything that needs to stay outside of the body outside. So it serves an extremely important barrier function. Mostly it keeps bacteria, fungi, toxic substances, pollutants, irritants out of the body. And it keeps moisture, water, precious salts, proteins inside of the body.
Jesse, when I think of an organ, I think of the heart, the lungs, liver, kidneys. They're always in movement. Doesn't skin just lie there like a protective coating?
No, the skin is actually quite biologically active. It does a lot in protecting us, but also from the bottom up, there's a lot of stuff going on under the skin that we can't see, protecting us from the sun, ultraviolet radiation, from the weathering elements outside. The skin's actually quite busy.
So how many layers are there?
Well, we usually talk about the skin having three layers. We have the epidermis, which is the tough, dry outer layer of our skin. Then we have the dermis, which is sort of the softer part underneath the top layer. And then we have the subcutaneous or fat layer, which is one of my favorite layers to talk about. I love fat.
And we'll probably talk more about fat later, because when we talk about all the different things that people do to their skin, we usually think only about the top layer, and yet that fat layer is important, isn't it? Michelle, in talking about what we mean by skincare, is there a dermatological definition? Is skincare the care of the entire organ or just the surface layer?
From a dermatologist standpoint, it's the care of all layers of the skin. So we're interested in the subcutaneous fat, interested in the dermis. We're interested in the superficial layer, the epidermis. And from the standpoint of individuals who might go to the store and buy products for their skin, they're mostly interested in the superficial layer. So moisturizers and soaps mainly are managing the superficial layer. But you can have skin diseases, rashes, inflammations, pain, itching that come from deeper layers of the skin, and that's what we deal with.
And does skincare also involve things like what we eat?
Oh, certainly.
Whether we exercise well, whether we sleep, things like that?
Absolutely. I would say from a nutritional standpoint, it's pretty well proven that the poorer your nutrition, the more aged the appearance of the skin over time. The skin requires fats, lipids, proteins. It requires all sorts of nutrients that we get in from our diet. And so if you're deficient in any of these things, the skin's not able to function the way it should.
Jesse, we think of the face and hands perhaps as the first focus of our attention when we look for skincare products. Is facial skin very different from the rest of our skin?
Well, definitely. The facial skin is one of the more thinner areas of the body. It has also a lot of blood vessels. It's very vascular. It also has a lot of oil, a lot of pores, and also hair. So when we treat the skin on the face, we know that it tends to heal a little bit faster because of all those blood vessels and hair follicles. We also know it tends to be quite responsive to, lasers, surgeries, even topicals that you put on, because it's an active area.
Well, what does it mean, Michelle, to clean your skin? How do the cleansers work?
So there are different types of cleansers. The original type, of course, is traditional soap. That's what we've had for centuries.
Well, now, you can still use ivory soap, or you can use oatmeal soap.
Absolutely. Or you can use detergents, which are different from soaps in that they're produced pharmacologically, but they function in the same way. So soaps and detergents are what we call amphiphilic substances. So they have a hydrophobic end an end that doesn't like water. It's afraid of water. And it has a hydrophilic end, an end that loves water. And when soaps or detergents are placed into water, they form what we call micelles. They protect their hydrophobic end at the center, and they form a little ball that's surrounded by their hydrophilic ends. So the hydrophilic micelle floats in the water. And when you put this detergent or a soap on your skin, a process called emulsification takes place, where the dirts, the oils, the things you want to remove from your skin, which are hydrophobic, are contained within these micelles. And then water is used to wash away the hydrophilic micelle.
Now, when you say it could be a soap or a detergent, my natural instinct is to automatically say, well, I'd prefer the soap to the detergent.
So certainly, traditionally, soaps are what we've always used, but actually soaps can be, to some extent, a little more harsh than some of the more gentle dilute detergents that are found in some of the newer cleansers.
And now we're seeing, well, we've been seeing for a long time, soaps that and detergents that also have lots of additives and scents. Are scents good for our skin?
Actually, unfortunately, scents and various perfumes are often what sensitizes our skin and causes allergies in many patients. So it's really best to choose a cleanser or moisturizer that's perfume-free or fragrance-free.
So, Jesse, let's talk about moisturizers.
Okay. I love moisturizers.
What does a simple moisturizer do for our skin? Is it sealing in water, or is it doing something more?
Yeah, well, a lot of moisturizers actually are humectants. What that means is they actually draw water from the environment surrounding, and they pull water out and deposit onto our skin. Moisturizers also commonly contain occlusives, which help hold and seal that moisturizer onto the top surface of our skin, so that, you know, we draw water in from the environment and we also seal it on the top, and that's what keeps our skin moist.
And what are the most common ingredients used in a moisturizer?
You'll see glycerin, you'll see dimethicone, you'll see things like mineral oils, petroleum. They all do different things. And most of them now, they're formulated very elegantly, so cosmetically they're not that greasy, not too sticky. They don't tend to cause clogging of the pores as much anymore.
Does keeping your skin moisturized prevent wrinkles?
It does not prevent wrinkles, but it can make your wrinkles less apparent. A lot of times we see wrinkles when the light reflects off the surface of the skin. You see sort of that ashy kind of look reflecting back, and what moisturizers do is they help with that skin reflection. The only way to prevent wrinkles really is, well, we could talk about that later, but moisturizers do not prevent wrinkling.
Well, Michelle, how do wrinkle creams work then?
Well, the most important of the so-called wrinkle creams, of course, is our prescription tretinoin, which is a retinoid or vitamin A derivative. Retinoids are a whole family of medications that are derived from vitamin A. And what's been shown in the lab is that retinoids actually reduce collagen degradation in the skin. So as through the passage of time and with various exposures such as ultraviolet light, collagen is degraded and so is elastic tissue.
And that's why we get wrinkles?
Exactly. That's why we get wrinkles. And there are enzymes that cause this degradation called matrix metalloproteinases. And retin A, or tretinoin, actually downregulates the production of these matrix metalloproteinases and also increases the production of collagen.
Well, some people get a lot more wrinkles as they age than others. Is that just because their DNA is different?
Certainly there are intrinsic factors that are related to aging, such as our genetic background and our genetic susceptibilities to the environmental factors or the extrinsic factors. And probably the most important is ultraviolet light. So ultraviolet light upregulates matrix metalloproteinases and leads to degradation of collagen and elastic tissue.
So when people do a lot of sunbathing, they're more likely to get wrinkly. But also when they smoke, for some reason, they seem to get wrinkles on their upper lip.
Absolutely. So that's been shown in tobacco studies that individuals who smoke and the length of time that they've been smoking, that they have also a prematurely aged appearance, including wrinkles and fine lines, as well as a pallor to the skin and also premature graying.
Jesse, what about treatment creams? There are thousands. Are there basic categories that we can break them into so that we can understand them better?
Sure. Well, we have the simple daily moisturizers, which are just simple, you know, humectants, emollients that help draw water to the skin and seal it in. Then you have your moisturizer with the sunblock built in, which is, I think, important for anyone's skincare. That's a basic to have an SPF built into your moisturizer. And then you have cleansers, which, you know, just do the simple action of getting rid of the oils and dirt in our skin from just daily environmental exposures. And in terms of treatment, we talk about the topical tretinoins, the retin-As, which we know are clinically proven to actually help rebuild collagen, help with, you know, prevent wrinkling and help just make our skin look better. Other treatment creams also include things like antioxidants. I don't know if we're going to talk about that later, but there are a lot of different Oak Lab companies now making topical treatment antioxidant creams.
I don't know if either of you are aware of the Consumer Reports studies that they conducted recently of skincare products. They measured change over the course of 12 weeks using a high-tech optical device to track changes in wrinkles and something called a corneometer to measure moisture, and found that some creams are mildly more effective than others at doing whatever they're supposed to do, diminish wrinkles, for example, but nothing had a dramatic effect. Is that generally understood to be the case?
It's pretty well accepted that most of the products on the market are fairly similar. Most of these over-the-counter moisturizers and anti-aging creams, there are some subtle differences in the proportions of the different humectants, emollients, or occlusive agents that are in these moisturizers.
Some cost a lot more than
others. That's true. Some of them are. Some of them maybe have different. They have different proportions. They claim to be more moisturizing because they have more of one ingredient or another. They may be perfumed in a different way or contain ingredients that company has studied independently outside of the general medical community, and they consider those more effective.
Well Jesse, the Consumer Reports researchers also found that cost wasn't necessarily relevant, that the luxurious nature and packaging of some costly creams didn't necessarily mean that they would be more effective. Do most people in the field see it that way too?
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. I believe that if it makes a person feel better to spend the money on having a more luxurious product, meaning the nicer packaging, maybe some nicer scents, you know, the person might use that product a little bit more, but it may not be doing anything more medically beneficial for them. Most of the time, you're really just paying for the packaging. You're not really paying for anything special in those ingredients. I'd rather my patients spend the money on the things that are more prescription strength because we know that they're actually working.
We'll take a little break in a moment. Our number here when we come back, because we want to take a lot of calls, is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Leave comments. Don't send me emails because I'm not going to be looking at emails, but you can go to our show page. And there is a way to get to the comments. It's pretty easy. One more thing before we go to the breaks. I have a beard, but I've always wondered about shaving because some people have told me that shaving is really good for men's skin because it scrapes off the top dead layer. Is that true?
Well, it does have an exfoliating effect, certainly, but the closer the shave in certain individuals who have curly hair, the closer the shave actually can inflame the skin because as the hair is growing back, it irritates the hair follicle and irritates the skin, and that can lead to acne and other facial eruptions.
Is men's skin, Jesse, all that different from women's skin? Hello, are you there?
I'm here. Do you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you now.
Okay, so men seem to have more oil glands. Their skin's a little bit more thicker. They tend to not, you know, they have more muscular thickness under the skin. They tend to age maybe a little bit better than women because they have that thicker skin and more sebaceous glands.
We will take a little break and come back with your calls. There's a lot of other things to talk about. Chemical peels. What else?
I'm sure we'll talk about some cosmetic procedures and a variety of other things that we do in the office.
And our number again, 212-433-9692. My guest, Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Jesse Chung, Associate Director of Cosmetic Dermatology and Assistant Professor of Dermatology at NYU Langone Medical Center.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me, so deep in my heart that you're really.
We're talking about skin and skin care on today's Please Explain with Drs. Jesse Chung and Michelle Hanjani. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. And we got a comment from Scotland, so I thought I would address that immediately. Julia from Scotland asks, I've read that Elizabeth I was possibly done in by her makeup. Can the epidermis soak in enough harmful substances to do real damage to the body?
Oh, absolutely. The body actually, the skin is actually able to absorb a great deal, and this has been measured in the lab. And certain medications that we apply topically, we have to worry and warn the patient that they shouldn't apply too much, because they do actually develop a blood level of some of these medications. And, you know, I don't know the details, but I know that there were makeups from centuries ago that had harmful ingredients like arsenic and lead.
And they go right down into the all three layers?
Many of these ingredients can be absorbed, and actually there are medications that are transepidermal, that are like estrogens and other medications that are given in the form of a patch that travel through the skin layers.
Let's take some calls. Naomi from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling to find out if any of those creams or oils that are marketed towards the relief of the appearance of stretch marks are actually effective, or are stretch marks permanent, like scarring to your skin?
And let me add cellulite to that question.
Right.
Jesse, you want to answer first?
Sure. Well, I tend to believe that the over-the-counter creams don't do too much for these scars or stretch marks or even cellulite. Scars are actually kind of deeper down in your skin, and topicals have a hard time penetrating and, you know, getting deep enough to cause any biological action. Back in the day, people used to use topical tretinoins, Retin A, in hopes of helping to decrease the appearance of the stretch marks. I think they help a little bit, but they're not great. Nowadays, I tend to tell my patients who hate their stretch marks, we just do lasers nowadays. Lasers actually are really, they do a good job on stretch marks. You can actually get them to blend in very well with your regular skin. Cellulite, there are a lot of lasers for cellulite. There are topicals that have caffeine that may temporarily, you know, swell the skin cells to make them look less dimply, but it's not a permanent solution. I don't think topicals will help cellulite. I think, you know, lasers or other surgical procedures will help cellulite more.
But exercise won't work?
Exercise may help tone the muscles underneath the cellulite, and it may decrease the fat in those areas. But cellulite is a combination of fat being dimpled down with little fibrous tissue. It's kind of like a mattress where you have the little dimples in the mattress. And when you get rid of the fat, sometimes cellulite can even look worse. We have some very skinny patients who actually have cellulite, and it's sort of, it's interesting, you know, how they develop it. But it's a combination of fat and the fibrous tissue. So exercise may not make your cellulite that much better, but exercise is healthy for you, so it's always a good thing to do.
Julie from, where are you from? Oh, from
Bethel, Connecticut.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm curious as to, is there any difference between the number 70, for example, sunscreen that my dermatologist says that I should buy via his office, which is, you know, more, which is pricey, versus the $12 bottle of Neutrogena that I could buy at the supermarket?
Well, differences in SPF are actually kind of interesting. An SPF of 15, when applied using the study standards of 2 milligrams per centimeter squared, which is actually quite a lot of sunscreen per centimeter squared, an SPF of 15 will provide about 93% coverage of ultraviolet light. An SPF of 30 is more like 97%. An SPF of 50 is about 98%. But when sunscreens are applied in typical use, individuals will usually obtain more like an SPF of maybe 20 to 50% of what the packaged SPF is. So if you use an SPF 15 and you put it on thick amounts, like 30 milliliters to cover your whole body, that's almost half a tube of your typical sunscreen, then you'll probably get 93% coverage. So an SPF 70 provides probably a little additional sun protection, probably not a lot if you're using it with study laboratory standards.
Now, if you're swimming, does it matter? When you go in the water, doesn't it pretty much wash all of that stuff off?
So water-resistant sunscreens will last, in study standards, 40 minutes after the application. So 40 minutes of submersion, it should last. So once you come out of the water, you need to reapply. And if you're going to be in the water more than 40 minutes, you should come out and reapply.
You wanted to add to that?
Well, I also just find that difference. All sunblocks aren't made equally. It's not only the SPF, it's also actually the ingredients that they are made of. You have physical blockers, which are basically ground up minerals like zinc or titanium, and then you have the chemical blockers that bind with your skin and actually absorb the sun rays, but over time they get degraded. So that may explain some of the difference in pricing in sunblocks, having the finely ground up minerals that actually don't react and are actually very good sunblock ingredients to have versus some of the chemicals, which some people can get allergic to, which also degrade in the sunlight. There are certain chemicals that we recommend that patients have in their sunblock, including avobenzone, which is also called Parsol 1789. Their companies have added stabilizers to this chemical, so it's actually one of the best sunscreen ingredients to have.
It might also be important to add that SPF only refers to ultraviolet B, not ultraviolet A. And both ultraviolet B and ultraviolet A can lead to skin cancer in the long term and photoaging. So if you use a sunscreen that has a high SPF, even an SPF of 70, you know that you have some nice degree of protection against UVB, but it's those ingredients that Jesse's mentioning that alert you as to whether you're getting protection against ultraviolet A as well. So Parsol 1789 and the physical blockers like titanium dioxide and zinc oxide also have coverage for ultraviolet A.
A listener writes in that she had a chemical peel when she was about 13. Her mother was worried about her having acne. Is that a bit early? She says it was a traumatic experience.
I think it depends on the type of chemical peel we had. A lot of our younger patients have what are called salicylic acid peels, and these are peels that are very nice for acne patients. They're quite superficial. What they do is they help get into that oil gland a little bit better and sort of just peel off all that skin and the little clogged up pore. They can be traumatic when you go at too strong a concentration, but when most offices we start off slow and see how the patient's skin responds, and then each time we repeat it, we go a little bit stronger. I don't think it's that early if she's actually having acne and the other topicals are too irritating for her.
Let's take another call. Marion from New York, you're on the air. Marion, you have to turn off your radio because we're on a little bit of a delay.
Hello?
Yes, Marion, turn off your radio, okay?
Oh,
you're going
to
be distracted.
Turn the radio off?
I think that's a good idea.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Marion.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, hi. I have a question about rosacea. My son has rosacea, but my daughter also, and I just wondered if there's any kind of a product out there. They've been using lanolanic acid. Oh, no, that's not tea tree oil. What would you suggest?
Rosacea is sometimes a tricky condition to treat. Rosacea involves a patient who has both acne and sensitive flushing skin. So it's important for these patients to avoid the triggers that cause their skin to flush, because if they continue to flush and encounter those triggers, their baseline redness will continue to go up. So these triggers include hot, spicy foods and beverages, extremes of temperature, emotional stressors, alcohol, caffeine. So those things should be avoided. And then in terms of overall skin care, they should use gentle cleansers that don't have harsh detergents. They should use good moisturizers with sunscreen, because ultraviolet light is a trigger of rosacea. And if they have an acne component to their rosacea, they're going to need to use very gentle acne medications to treat their pimples. So it's very difficult to treat, and the treatment is specific to the individual.
Now, why do people get acne?
So that's another interesting question. Acne is thought to occur from a variety of factors. It has to do in part with the ability of an individual's sebaceous glands to produce oils called sebum. So the more sebum they produce, the more cell division that occurs at the orifice of the follicle where the pimple occurs, and the more bacteria, usually Propionibacterium acnes, which is the acne-forming bacteria, the more of these factors that this individual has, the more likely they are to have acne. And if you have higher levels of male hormones, such which are androgens, you usually have more sebum production and more of these three criteria that cause acne.
So is acne more likely in males than females?
Yes, so acne is definitely more common and usually more severe in men than in women, but that's not to say that there aren't women who have equally severe acne.
Okay, let's go now to Delilah in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, Delilah.
Yes, my question is about spider veins on the face. I'm 41 years old, and I have many spider veins on my face, and I would like to know about prevention treatment.
Jesse?
Sure. I find that spider veins are very common as the skin gets older. The collagen sort of degrades and you have less support to the vascular structures in your skin, so the spider veins become more apparent. And also pregnancy hormones can also lead to the development of spider veins too. The best treatment, I think the safest one that causes no scarring, is actually using a laser. What the lasers do is they target the actual color of the spider vein and they just sort of zap it and blast it away. And you may have a little bit of pinkness or swelling after that laser, but nowadays we don't have to bruise you to treat it, and usually one or two treatments is enough to get rid of that spider vein.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Justin in Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Okay, Justin.
Very good. I have a question regarding how true it is about the natural alternatives to, you know, store-bought moisturizers or cleansers. Is it any truth to the, you know, the myth, I guess, that banana peels or avocados may serve as a better alternative to store-bought, you know, moisturizers and or cleansers?
Well, you told us your opinion. You said it was a myth, but is it a myth?
Not necessarily. Now, there are certainly, so there are oils in moisturizers. Moisturizers are typically oil and water mixtures, and those oils can be manufactured or they can be natural. So natural products typically will have natural oils.
So I could be rubbing bananas or avocados on my face and helping myself?
Well, most likely they've extracted some natural oil from that. Now, the downside, of course, is that natural products are more likely to have allergens than manufactured products, which when they're manufactured, we try to avoid the molecules that people tend to be allergic to.
When we look at facial hair, men's facial hair, is that connected to skin? For example, I've always wondered why some people have red beards, some don't, and of course, hair all comes out of follicles in the skin, doesn't it?
Well, red hair is due to, they believe that it's due to a melanocortin-1 receptor mutation. There's a genetic mutation that redheads seem to have, and that leads the melanocytes within their hair follicles to produce red hair. And those individuals also seem to have more sensitivity to ultraviolet light and freckling and skin cancer. Mm-hmm. So hair is certainly part of the skin, and that the hair follicle is a skin appendage. It lives within the skin, and things that affect the skin also affect the hair. So if you have inflammation of the skin, you're likely to have inflammation of the hair, and the hair could be lost.
Listener asks about chlorinated water. Jesse, does that, because after you go swimming for a while, you definitely see some reaction in your skin.
Oh, sure. Chlorinated water can be quite irritating, especially if you have sensitive skin. A good way to help treat that is make sure you get a good shower after you swim, get a good soap and scrub all that chlorinated water off, and then get a good moisturizer on to seal in that moisture. Some people even notice their hair may change color in the chlorine. It gets a little bit green. I believe that there are some companies that make special shampoos to help with that green chlorine hair look.
Selden in Brooklyn left a comment on our show page wondering if pore strips are effective or bad for your skin.
Oh, I think they're very effective, actually. So there are pore strips that some individuals are genetically predetermined to have a little bit larger pores than other individuals, and so they're more likely to have skin debris and oils trapped within these pores, and the pore strips are able to extract that debris. Now, I certainly wouldn't use them frequently. I'd probably use them once every couple of months, because if you use them too frequently, you're going to irritate your skin.
Another listener asks if there are certain vitamins and certain foods that are especially helpful for your skin. Do you recommend any, Jesse?
I believe that, well, the least processed your foods are, the healthier they are. There's a whole movement now towards, you know, the whole foods being more organic. I do believe that fresh fruits and vegetables have a lot of great vitamins in them that are quite biologically active. We tend to think that the fruits and vegetables that are more colorful tend to have the best antioxidants in them. So blueberries, strawberries, anything brightly colored is going to be good for your skin. If you eat a pretty healthy diet, I think that's probably enough for you. The most important thing is really to stay out of the sun.
A listener also wants to know if you can comment about dark circles under the eyes at an early age.
Those are one of the biggest complaints of my patients I see for cosmetics. It's usually a combination of multiple factors, those dark circles under your eyes. Sometimes it's a loss of volume in that area. The fat under your eyelids actually travels down into your chin and your jowls as you get older, so you get a little depression there. Sometimes the skin in that area gets more crepey from the muscles in those eyes. Just the repetitive twitching of those muscles makes that skin a little bit more wrinkly and crepey. And then people tend to have more blood vessels that show through as the skin thins, so you have more vascular congestion, so it looks kind of bluish tinge from the blood underneath it. So to treat that, it's a combination of sometimes we laser that, sometimes we Botox it, sometimes we put some fillers in very deep over the bone to help plump the skin back out. Topicals, I would say, maybe some topical tretinoin or Retin-A would help to rebuild some of that collagen there, but there's not much else you can do in terms of topical creams to help rebuild.
In 5 seconds, are dermis scrubs a good idea?
A scrub's a good idea. Oh, they do exfoliate the skin and help it rejuvenate, but probably not an essential part.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Jesse Chung, Associate Director of Cosmetic Dermatology at NYU Langone Medical Center. On Monday's show, live from Afghanistan, former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase gives us an update on what's happening there. And then Army Gunner Ryan Conklin discusses his experience serving on the front lines in Iraq. Also, Olga Grushin on her second novel, The Line. And science writer Stephen Hall traces the history of wisdom from philosophy to neuroscience. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Ida Sadakiani, and contributing producer Bonnie LeFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Monday at noon.